Afternoon, everyone. We'll call the Joint Committee on Health and Human Services Reform and Finance Committee to order. And members, today we're doing another overview that's letting us kind of delve a little bit more into Department of Human Services specifically. And so we have Assistant Commissioner Koppel here to give us the overview. You have materials in your packet. So thank you for being here, Mr. Koppel. If you want to introduce yourself and then go on with your presentation, we are ready and willing to listen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, or both committees. I'm Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. For those of you who I've worked with in the past, I have just recently moved in the middle of December from the Department of Health, where I was the Deputy Commissioner. Now I'm at the Department of Human Services. So when you see me, please don't ask me any health questions anymore. I won't know any answers. I didn't have a lot before, but I'll have less in the future. I'm here today to follow up Commissioner Jessam's testimony from yesterday and try to help show how many of the programs that she went through yesterday impact families. So today's presentation will be very much from a family perspective, and there are six examples that I'll run through of a family, and when I say family, it could be with children or without, but six situations and what kinds of programs impact those situations and how they can be helpful to those families. So with that, I will, and please, as I go through and you have questions, please just, I know you might anyway, but please feel free to stop me and ask your questions. You don't need to wait till I'm done, because most of this will be very applicable family by family. So stop any time. So the first one, and I'll try to remember. That's not the right button. Okay, I messed it up. Sorry. So the first one is, example is a mother with two children. We'll call her Mary. She's recently lost her job, has two children, and is separated from her husband. She is not eligible for unemployment insurance and therefore applies to the Minnesota Family Investment Program and for child care assistance. With no other income available, Mary will receive $532 in cash assistance. So as I give you this, I'm trying to give you the exact nature of how this impacts a family. Each of these would be different with different families, but this just gives you a good idea of how these programs work. And these are very, for the most part, typical kinds of stories. So she will get $532 in cash assistance through the MFIP program and $459 in food assistance through SNAP, previously many years ago called the food stamp program. And I know there are some new legislators here, and so I'm trying to be educational if I can. The federal poverty level for a family of three is $1,649 a month. So these above two items totaled $991 a month, just to give you a perspective of how much money cumulatively is in this, in the help she receives. And then while looking for work, Mary is also eligible and can receive child care assistance. So this, now we can move to some broad context from this story, which is of the 90,000 individuals in an average month served by MFIP, 71% are children. In MFIP, and by the way, that's the lowest amount, this is projected, that's the lowest amount since 2000 involved in the program. In fact, I don't think it's been under 100,000 before this. But the majority are children, If you were to look at cases, that's less than 40,000 cases, but 90,000 total individuals involved. About one-third of these children are 5 years old or younger, and child care assistance is provided for about 31,000 children on an average month. I think it's important to recognize that about one-third of these children are 5 years old or younger. When we talk about the importance of child care and early childhood development, and making sure that these children are ready for school, ready to learn, healthy development, all of those themes are very important. Food support. As I said, she was eligible for food stamps. In 2013, more than 533,000 Minnesotans on an average month received SNAP. The number of families in MFIP, I mentioned, just over 90,000. Far more families receive SNAP and are eligible for SNAP. It goes up to, I believe, 135% of poverty and 65% of poverty, which, by the way, for those of you who like numbers, would be $2,721 a month for a family of three. So food stamps or SNAP go to a lot more families and fill the nutrition void. Almost all food stamp support is federally funded. So Mary claims both children as tax dependents. As I mentioned, she has no other income, and the income she receives is excluded in terms of eligibility for other programs. So the family is eligible for medical assistance. Eligibility for medical assistance is based on 133% of poverty. This would be $2,193 a month or less, and you would be eligible for medical assistance. And that's for a household size of three. The children are, let me digest this. Eligibility for MA is 133, and for 275% for children, parents with children in Minnesota care. So we have two different programs there. But medical assistance, I'll jump back to that. Medical assistance for families with children is the largest publicly funded healthcare program. The average enrollment of individuals in MA was 739,000 or will be projected in 2015. 59% of the families are with children. Most enrollees get their healthcare through health plans. The rest get it on a fee-for-service basis, with providers billing the state directly for those services. MA is jointly funded federal, state, and county, some county funds. There is no asset test for families with children and adults.
Mr. Koppel, can I just interrupt with one quick question?
Yes.
On that slide where it says most enrollees get their health care through health plans?
Yes.
Most would use, I don't know if you have number like firm numbers in front of you, are we talking like 90% higher than that get it through plans versus the fee for service?
Is there, what's the percent? 75%?
75% get it through the plan,
through the rest
are fee for service.
Through the prepaid.
Okay, PMAP program.
Contracts.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel. Representative Liebling.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on that, Mr. Koppel, and maybe you don't know this, but, I mean, everybody who applies can't just say, oh, I want to be in fee-for-service, right? It's the fee-for-service tends to be people with disabilities, and I don't exactly know what categories, but, you know, a family like what you've described, unless there's some special circumstance, they're going to be on the one of the health plans, right? Am I correct on that?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, that is correct. Either their circumstances or where they are applying will determine that. What part of the state, perhaps, if it's got a PMAP contract, but most are. Any other questions on that family? because we're going to move to a new family, Melissa and Jenny. Melissa's a single mother, and Jenny is age 14. Jenny was diagnosed with a developmental disability shortly after birth, and while her mother has been able to support her without services, as she's gotten older, her needs have changed and more help needs to be provided. So next slide, Melissa requests a developmental disability waiver for her daughter to receive case management, teaching and training services to help her become more independent. And in order to receive this developmental disability waiver, her daughter needs to be eligible for medical assistance. If the family's income is too high for medical assistance, Melissa can, the mother, can apply through TEFRA option for her daughter. If a child is found to have a disability and require institutional level care, the TEFRA option will look at a child's income alone to determine eligibility for medical assistance. Once found eligible for medical assistance, she can receive services for her needs, including a personal care attendant to help with daily activities. So this, a part of medical assistance, has grown over the years. There's been a lot of discussion about it, but this is specifically for children with disabilities, and it has gone beyond the criteria we've used for medical assistance, and I believe it'll be there are other waivers that included in this is the developmental disabilities waivers you see at the bottom of the next page, but there are other waivers included or options for people with disability with four categories. Any questions? I'm going through some quicker than others, but if anyone would like to probe deeper.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to point out for the committee that one of the reports that we had asked for and that the department put together at the end of the year was a waiting list report, and the developmental disability waiver is one of those that has thousands of people on the waiting list. And so, you know, where we're able to meet the needs of people in some programs, other programs have really big waiting lists, and this is one of those.
Mr. Koppel, any comments on that, or we have one other question, too?
Just to follow up on that is, I didn't mention, for instance, in child care, the sliding fee child care program also has waiting lists, depending on what county, but in most counties there are waiting lists, and there are over, I believe, 8,000 families on that waiting list now, and that is not a true number of need, because many of those families, when they find out how long they need to wait, don't even go onto a waiting list. But nonetheless, we have a waiting list in that program as well.
And to that point, Mr. Koppel, I know that the waiting lists for child care are by county. Is that also the same for the other waivered programs? Is it a by county list, or is it just one statewide waiting list?
Madam Chair, I'm getting help from the gallery.
No problem.
It is a statewide list.
It is. Okay. Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thanks for your presentation, Commissioner Koppel. See, back on page three, it says, while looking for work, Mary also receives child care assistance. Is that in addition to the 991?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, yes.
Okay.
I only pointed out the 991 is the cash side. Statewide average for payment for fiscal year 13 is the latest year I have. Per month is about $962 for child care.
Representative Grunhagen.
Just a follow-up question then. Okay, let's say Mary is fortunate and she gets married, then her husband's income would also come to bear on her benefits and could decrease it. Is that correct?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, yes. Depending on the economics of, it's an eligibility program. And also, she may continue to be eligible, the child, for child care, but maybe their payments, their share would go higher. It just would depend on how much income was in the family.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. If Mary doesn't get married and just lives with a guy, it doesn't affect her benefits, correct?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair and Representative Gruhagen, I would have to find out. And I don't know if anybody is can give me a nod. Yes, is that it would not affect her benefits? Yes. I believe that you are correct. That's what I'm hearing.
Okay, and I'm sure Representative Gruenhagen can continue to follow up. Do you have another follow-up question,
yeah,
Representative Gruenhagen?
Yeah, so it just appears that the government program undermines getting married because it takes away benefits for women if they get married because the man's income is now counted, and if they just live together, then it's not counted. They keep the benefits, and it just undermines a traditional family from my perspective.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Shifting gears back to child care. I am wondering there, Mr. Koppel, if it's possible for the last 10 years, and I know it's probably going to take you a little bit, but I am interested in knowing the number of providers in each county over the last 10 years to see ebbs and flows and try to figure out, I know that there is a major child care shortage across the state. Greater Minnesota especially is being hit really hard right now. It's hard to find infant care. So I just kind of like to know those numbers. If you could get those to me, that would be great. And one more thing I'd like to add to that is also the rates that the state has paid for CCAP over the last 10 years as well.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, and I could be mistaken. I believe that county-based rates are determined, you know, so they're going to vary by county.
Yep.
So do you want to see them by county or?
That is correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Koppel, your presentation seemed to indicate that the average MFIB family has just a little under 2.5 children per family, what, 2.448 or so. Do you have something you could share with us that gives sort of the breakout of ages and you know, some of those demographics? Because I know it's more difficult if you have two under two and, you know, those type of things. Just offline, we can get that info.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, to your point, if you look at the total number of individuals in the on MFIP, I believe I said it was 92,000. That's the total. So it wouldn't be that, and two-thirds or 75,000 were children, and the remainder were adults. So I think you would come to, I thought there was a little under two per family, but I can get you that number if that's your specific question.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where you said 71% were children in the NFIB family, I was trying to get a better feel for the breakup because there's a different cost matrix if you've got two children that are under two than if you had an infant and a five-year-old, etc. So if you had some more broad demographic information you could share when we debate which different programs will have a better understanding of their impacts and effectiveness, you know, with that pool of people.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, so we'll try to get a breakout of the age of the children in MFIP and in terms of average family size and what those demographics look like. Okay, thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a great conversation earlier with a good friend of mine, Representative Abler, today. Thank you, Jim, for your sage advice. A question to Mr. Koppel regarding waivers and disability waivers in regards to the four waivers that are offered. In the brain injury waiver, is there an age and a requirement for that as to how that brain injury occurs, if it's done through an accident or perhaps a chemical substance abuse? And there, are there other waivers for individuals who have a mental health issues into those four categories of waivers that have now?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, I'm going to ask someone to come down. That was a home run. I can't answer.
If you could just introduce yourself for the record.
Hello, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Disability Services Division at the Department of Human Services. So I heard your first question, Representative McDonald, so I'll answer that, and then if you could repeat the other question. So for the brain injury waiver, a person needs to be under the age of 65 at the time of application to that waiver. There is no age limit aside from under 65 on when the brain injury would need to occur in the person's lifetime.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, I didn't hear your name.
Heidi Hamilton.
Ms. Hamilton. Thank you. And that brain injury, is it just a accidental, or is it from birth and or a chemical issue, chemical injury?
Ms. Hamilton.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, the brain injury waiver is for both acquired and traumatic brain injury. It used to be just a traumatic brain injury, but now it is also applies to people with acquired brain injury. I'll have to get more detail about whether chemical cause of a brain injury would apply, but I will get that to you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. I believe I forgot my second question, but you answered the most important one. So I'd love to discuss this offline further later today.
Absolutely.
Okay, I don't see any other questions at this time, so let me keep moving forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I would say, in general, all of these community-based waivers that are on this page are available when people have higher needs than what's available through traditional medical assistance. And the waivers are intended to prevent people from being institutionalized or help people move out of institutions and receive similar supports in their community. So that's what the general theme of these waivers are.
Oh, I went to the wrong one again. There we go. I'm going to have to back up.
This page is average monthly costs and enrollment in those programs. And that's just for your own knowledge. Next family, Robert and Justin. Robert is a single father who earns $27,000 a year at his job, but that's not enough to pay for child care. He doesn't know much about child care, but wants the best for his son, who is age 4. So we're going to talk about child care assistance program and a parent aware.
And just briefly, I'm just going to interrupt Mr. Koppel. Just for the audience sake, we did not have extra copies of all these packets for distribution. Obviously, the slides are up, but there's also a copy of it up on the Health Committee Finance page if you wanted to follow along on an electronic device, just for your reference. So sorry about that, Mr. Koppel. You can keep going.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the Child Care Assistant Basic Sliding Fee Program can help pay for costs of child care. Families who are not currently or recently receiving assistance through the Minnesota Family Investment Program are eligible for child care assistance through the Basic Sliding Fee Program as well. As I mentioned, the waiting list that's being maintained is a total of 6,157 families as of November 2014, and that was over 17 counties at that waiting list. So the quality rating system, which we call Parent Aware in Minnesota, is a quality rating improvement system for child care and early education programs. It provides information to parents on quality, and it also provides technical assistance and training grants available to center-based child care providers, family child care providers, Head Start programs, and school-based pre-kindergarten programs. We are expanding that program to go statewide as currently. We are the lead agency in the parent aware implementation, and we are in coordination with the Minnesota Office of Early Learning and their scholarship program, and they also use this and pointing out the quality rating systems throughout the state. Going back to Robert, he earns $2,250 a month, which is 172% of poverty. And I keep putting this in here just so you can equate percentages with numbers. He is eligible for Minnesota Care because his income is under 200% of the federal poverty guideline for two, which is $2,621 per month. His coverage will begin the month following his when his eligibility is approved, and he will pay a monthly premium of $38. His son, who is 3 years old, is eligible for medical assistance. The income limit for medical assistance is 275% of poverty for children. So children have a much more generous opportunity to get health care and their parents, but and their parents make a share in the cost of the coverage as well.
Representative Loeffler has a question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Assistant Commissioner Capo. I just wanted to point out that in this story, Robert needs help with child care. That was part of your premise. But even if he's found eligible because of those waiting lists, if he lives in a county, if he lives in my county, in Hennepin County, he would probably have to wait 24 to 30 months to be able to get anything. So his son, even though he's eligible, is age 4, and he would be 6.5 years old, likely, before Jonathan and his son would get any help, which is why we end up with the situation of latchkey kids, and you know, you maybe wouldn't let a 4-year-old stay alone, but you'd be surprised at the ages at which some kids are just left alone because their parents don't qualify and they're waiting on the waiting list. But I was really surprised to hear that the waiting list time is that long, even if you're eligible.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, that's correct. And as I mentioned earlier, I think in some cases when families see that they need to wait 2 years because due to a waiting list, they don't sign up. And so in many cases, that waiting list is not necessarily reflect the true demand for child care, even though there is a waiting list. I kind of equate it to a 3-hour wait at a restaurant. You probably won't put your name on for reservations. So it's the same mentality. This is just briefly on Minnesota Care. The average monthly Minnesota Care enrollment is 125,000. Minnesota Care covers people who can't afford health insurance and have higher incomes than those served on the medical assistance program. So it's that in-between population, and as I mentioned, there is a sharing in the premium. Eligibility rules changed in 2014 to align with the Affordable Care Act. Under the new rules, primary parents and adults without children are enrolled in Minnesota Care. Most children and pregnant women are now eligible for MA. So there's a split between those two.
And Mr. Koppel, would you say it's true? I mean, Minnesota Care is a bit of an original type program, something that's pretty unique about Minnesota in terms of, a lot of times we refer to it helping the working poor, but it's one thing that Minnesota's recognized in terms of providing a safety net for those folks.
Yes, Madam Chair, it was passed in 1992 and was really first of its kind and has... There are other states that have emulated or copied that model, and it has changed over time as well. I'm going to move to the next story. This is the story of Jacob. Jacob is a seventh grader who is withdrawn, harsh outbursts, interspersed with silence. His guidance counselor calls the school. calls into school's contracted mental health clinic for an assessment. The licensed psychologist gives a preliminary diagnosis, and Jacob's individual education program team adds treatment sessions to his individual educational program. Since Jacob's family has medical assistance coverage, the school bills MA for that community psychologist services. Lacking MA, the School Link grant could be used if MA wasn't available. I'm going to keep going, and next slide is that. Yes,
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just on medical assistance, my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Commissioner Koppel, is that the first 2 years under the ACA, there was a bump in reimbursement to medical professionals, and that's coming off now, or dropping down after 2 years, is my understanding.
Mr. Koppel, I don't know if that might be a little outside of the realm of what you, but if you want to speak to that, that's great, or know the answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I'm seeing a nod that is correct. That was for primary care.
Yep. And then
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, one of the things I've observed is that more and more healthcare providers are, you know, even on their advertisements, sometimes it says we don't accept Medicaid, or that, you know, they're not accepting Medicaid anymore. Do you see that going forward, that access to health care, even though you're on medical assistance, is going to be a concern?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I wouldn't be able to give you a good insight into that because that's not my area in the department. I think, again, there's regional variation in access to providers. Certainly, oral health care has been a big priority in the past and still remains a concern. So I think we're constantly looking and concerned about having providers, having the workforce and the providers and the reimbursement all working to serve our population. Okay, now, that was a quick one, that last story. Very specific concern. I'm going to move to Marcus, another individual, in this case, an adult. He's a veteran, has been in and out of the work due to difficulties with depression and chemical dependency. He is homeless, living on the streets, and he may qualify for benefits to get a shelter. He is also likely for chemical dependency treatment. Sorry to do that. Okay, sorry. Next slide. So Marcus is eligible to stay at a shelter where his room and board is covered through the group residential housing. That is a Department of Human Services program. He receives $97 a month for personal needs through the general assistance program. Marcus is assisted with getting on supplemental security income, which is $733 a month, the Minnesota Supplemental Aid program, which is additional $81, SNAP at $16 a month, and medical assistance, for a total of $830 in benefits. Federal poverty level for one person is $972.50 monthly. I want to point out, I know Representative Grunhagen pointed to this earlier, the medical assistance is not part of that cash benefit, $830. That's a medical benefit, so it wouldn't be included in that number. Due to the tight rental market and lack of available Section 8 vouchers, Marcus will need some assistance paying for stable housing, and there's either a state rental subsidy program or an income supplement program or a program funded through the HUD McKinney-Vento grant program. What we try to do here is the group residential housing can be temporary
And if they want, if folks want to get into permanent individual housing, that's where this last bullet fits. Housing programs.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Curious at what point in that scenario on that veteran you just outlined, at what point would anybody in your office contact the VA?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, I'm going to need to see if someone with more familiar with that program.
If you could just introduce yourself for the tape.
My name is Christine Davis. I'm a policy specialist at the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, Representative, the question regarding the veterans' benefits could be addressed at application at the county. So when eligibility is being determined, that is an opportunity where people may be referred to veterans' benefits if they're not currently receiving them.
Representative Purcell.
I guess my question goes a little bit more pointed than that. In the scenario you presented, the person has some perceived, anyway, according to that, mental health issues, and that's something that the VA is trying to undertake with a much more serious endeavor. And that's what I'm getting at, not benefits that you would seek help from the VA.
Ms. Davis.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, the veterans' benefits may indeed be much more suited and targeted towards the needs of that individual. If people are accessing those benefits, they might not need or access the benefits in this scenario. Especially as related to the mental health services. The veterans' benefits may more specifically address those needs than the room and board housing payments described here.
Representative Purcell.
Just, is there an automatic connection between the state and the VA in this scenario? I guess that's where I'm trying to get at. Does somebody say, yeah, we got a veteran here, looks like he's got issues, call the VA?
Ms. Davis?
You know,
or Mr. Koppel?
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, I know this much, that there's a Heading Home Minnesota, which is ending homelessness in Minnesota. So in this particular case of a homeless vet, I do know that is a coordinated effort, and that the coalition or the state interdisciplinary team of commissioners includes veteran services, and so they are very engaged, and that is a priority for the homelessness initiative is targeted toward those vets. So on a specific example of how that would happen on the ground, I'm not as clear to me today. I can certainly get back to you on how that would work, but I do know that is the priority within our homeless community.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just offer that perhaps we can get some insurance that's going to happen. I think it would be prudent for the state of Minnesota to know that the VA is going to be contacted.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question along the group residential housing side of things. If this scenario has changed slightly and you have the homeless vet who is not receiving a lot of these services, but more in the receiving the group residential housing, and they had a part-time job, how does that work in terms of job income loss compared to offsetting for group residential housing? Do they, for every extra dollar over a certain amount, do they lose dollar for dollar type of thing? How does that work out?
Ms. Davis.
Madam Chair, Representative, the budget for an individual who is working would depend on the basis of their eligibility. So for some people, they may be they would always, the group residential housing program requires people to pay their income, any income first, prior to the state supplement paying up to the allowable rate. So if someone were working, there may be some earned income disregards that would not be counted that a person may keep. Today, we have some Social Security methods, so people, if they were on SSI, they would be able to keep $65 and a half of everything else they make. If someone were on general assistance, they would not count the first $50, and they would have an opportunity to set aside up to an additional $500 a month, totaling an extra $2,000 as a set aside that would not be counted in their budget.
Okay, I think we can keep moving forward. Mr. Koppel?
Thank you. Okay, so people who receive housing services, and again, this is through Department of Human Services. Housing Finance has other programs, but families with children, youth, single adults, most of the adults served have disabilities, developmental and physical mobility disabilities, mental illness, or chemical dependency. And I should point out that children and youth make up 46% of Minnesota's homeless population in 2012. General assistance and Minnesota supplemental aid. Again, you were told in general about these programs yesterday. General assistance helps individuals with little or no income meet their basic needs. Very small grant. Minnesota supplemental aid is an income supplement for people who receive federal SSI, Social Security, supplemental Social Security income, excuse me, and who are just over the SSI limit, just narrowly. Here's the average caseload, monthly caseload, 23,216 people on GA. Typical monthly benefit is $203 for an individual, $260 for a couple. Minnesota supplemental aid, 30,000 people on average per month, with a typical monthly benefit of $81 for individual and $111 per couple.
Mr. Koppel, could I ask you a brief question? You know, obviously some of these programs, what gets complicated for folks is understanding there's so many and how they interact and things of that nature. We don't have to talk about today, but is there any information available for future discussion where it shows how some of these overlay? Do most people on MA also get general assistance and supplemental aid? Is there a lot of overlapping of those, or are they pretty much separate populations? Could you just comment briefly, and then maybe we can get further information down the road?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It varies. There are some programs that are typically synced. For instance, if you are on MFIP, you're going to be receiving health care coverage. That would be a very tightly knit one. For a lot of these waivers that I discussed are very niche waivers, are very specific to mostly related to a disability or accident, injury. The general assistance and the Minnesota supplemental aid programs and a lot of the housing programs are addressing our homelessness and our very, very low income populations who are not typically eligible for other programs. So in some ways there's some overlap, but I think and to some degree today while I'm telling these stories, we've tried to put the overlap in where there would be, most commonly. It's not to say couldn't find a situation where there might be some more overlap, but this is the typical, very general way they're linked.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Koppel, given the fact that we have a very substantial reduction in unemployment that's been highlighted numerous times, it would appear or seem reasonable to me that there would be ebbs and flow of people on the programs that you cite. I'm wondering, in light of the highlighted nature of our unemployment, why we're not seeing fewer people on these programs. I wonder if you could comment to that.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I think the numbers that I'm giving you are not current with the unemployment numbers, so to some degree there's a lag of numbers. However, I would say that, as I mentioned, with the MFIP population, projections are that's the lowest it's been since 2000. So we are seeing some reductions, and I could try to get you the most recent numbers so that we might begin to see or realize if there are. And conversely, you know, for instance, the need for child care is probably going up as a result of employment. So you've got both some things that will reflect that increase in employment that might increase enrollment in certain programs. But I can try to get you the most recent numbers. Thank you. So while Marcus is awaiting for his SSI determination, he is eligible for medical assistance as an adult without children. He does not have an asset test. An income limit for an adult without children is 133% of poverty, or $1,293 a month for medical assistance. He will continue to be eligible for MA if he is approved for SSI. That SSI grant would be, I believe, less than $1,000, so it wouldn't affect his eligibility. Okay, I believe we're moving to the last story. I don't know if you're as relieved as I am. This is the last story, but I'm glad.
Representative Halverson.
Well, I'm not ready for it to be over. Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I did want to just loop back to that previous story and connect on the chemical dependency issue and inquire about providers for chemical dependency services that work with Rule 25. I've heard of different organizations being in the program and then out of the program, so some, especially in greater Minnesota, folks have more trouble getting service, and I'm wondering if you can comment on that.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair.
Phoning a friend.
We are going to answer that question momentarily.
If you could just introduce yourself for the tape.
Yeah, good afternoon. My name is Jeffrey Hunsberger. I'm from the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division at DHS. Madam Chair, Representative, was the question about individuals no longer being eligible for Rule 25 and being eligible and then ceasing to be eligible? Was that the issue?
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question really was about the providers of the treatment for people who are in Rule 25. Is it a challenge to find providers in certain parts of the state? And I'll just, not to call anybody out in particular, but one of the providers that I'm thinking about is Hazelden, because they are popping up with more presence throughout the state, and I've heard that they were providing some services for the county up in Chisago County and other places and then not providing it. So are you finding that it's hard to find people to consistently be part of that system?
Yeah,
Mr. Hunsberger.
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't have licensed chemical dependency treatment programs equally distributed across the state, and we have pockets of population that are less well served than others. Rural populations may not support chemical dependency programs, and so they have to travel great distances to get to treatment programs. I can't speak directly to the Hazelden issue, but I do know that they had not been participating when I last looked in the Rule 25 publicly paid chemical dependency treatment system. It's a voluntary process, and for county placing authorities who have a significant share of the cost of every treatment placement, program, a program that doesn't accept the rates that are paid by chemical dependency, paid to chemical dependency programs through the state system, wouldn't be attractive. It would not choose to make that placement.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to follow up on that, so there are people who are prescribed inpatient treatment or outpatient treatment, and sometimes it's a 30-day treatment, and sometimes people are, you know, recommended to have 90-day treatment. Are those really intensive programs available to folks in Rule 25, or do we find that people get referred to programs that might not be as robust of a treatment program as they need because we don't have providers available or we don't have dollars available?
Mr. Hunsberger.
Madam Chair, Representative, there is a single measure, the Rule 25 assessment, that is to be used for all publicly placed clients in Minnesota. It is designed to identify people who need residential treatment, and there are three varieties: low, medium, and high intensity residential treatment, or non-residential treatment. That is designed to be equally distributed or equally applied to people regardless of where they live. There may be variations. I can't speak to that yet.
Okay, and then we can move forward. Thank you, Mr. Koppel.
Are we moving on? Thanks a
lot. Okay, Madam Chair, the last story is Marcus and Bill. This focus of this is Bill, who is an 88-year-old, has multiple chronic conditions and limitations in daily activities, but desires to remain in his own apartment. Bill is on Medicare and is financially eligible for medical assistance. He has a care coordinator through his health plan. His care coordinator assesses his need for assistance and determines he's eligible for an elderly waiver, which will pay for services to help keep him in his apartment. He chooses to receive home-delivered meals through the elderly waiver, homemaking, assistance with bathing, and a weekly nurse visit to set up medications and monitor his health conditions. The elderly waiver pays for transportation for him to visit his son as well. Elderly waiver and alternative care for older adults in Minnesota provides community alternatives to nursing homes for people 65 years old or older. Again, much like the other waivers, this is to prevent people from being institutionalized or to give them the most viable options in their homes. Elderly waivers for people who are financially eligible for long-term care under medical assistance and who meet level of care need requirements. And the alternative care is for people with low income and assets who are not eligible for medical assistance who meet level of care requirements. Here's an idea of how many people are on the program and the cost, the average monthly cost for the program. Medical assistance for persons over 65 or blind or disabled. Elderly people and people with disabilities make up 31% of the total enrollment in medical assistance, but 66% of the total expenditures. This was at fiscal year 13. People with disabilities who work and earn more than $65 a month may be eligible for MA for employed persons with disabilities. There is no income test for MA employed persons with disabilities. There is a $20,000 asset limit, and eligible people must pay a monthly premium for coverage.
Representative McDonald.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to wait for Mr. Koppel to finish with this slide when the back slide says questions and answers, but he's almost done, so I'll wait for him for that slide.
That sounds good. Sorry to cut you short, Mr. Koppel.
Well, Madam Chair, with that, then, I'll do that.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay, let's go represent McDonald then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Koppel, your comment about being glad that the review is done reminds me of Tax Chairman David's comment today in the Tax Committee that the overviews of the agency can be sometimes like chewing on glass or watching paint dry. I thought that was quite an interesting comment, but your overview has been so helpful, and I will say kudos to you for hitting a home run as well. After being here 4 years and putting all of this, our programs that help people who need help in our state, and that's why we're here, because each and every one of us care about those people, this really puts it in context, and after a third term, it really is very helpful. Now, with that, I'll turn it into a question regarding the last slide. I think there's a... We have certain individuals in our state who have mental health issues, not physical disabilities. They physically can work, but mentally they cannot. There are state programs, the waivers, to help them, as you have here on your slide. But sometimes an individual won't do what's required to receive that waiver, the help. See a psychologist, take 10 hours of work, and get that help. But there are individuals that are going to the doctors and dentists in emergency rooms, but not a psychologist because they know better. What can we do to help those folks get the help that they need and the waivers who have struggled with that issue?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, first, thank you for your compliment. I'm glad it was productive for you and hopefully for other members. And I have to really say it was the staff at the department that put the presentation together, and I'm pretty much the deliverer of that, so it's a shared with them. And with that, though, your question I can answer, and that's why I wanted to say it was the department that helped me, because I'm very much in need of someone right now to, it's an outreach question, I believe, is what you're talking about, is for people who are in need of these services or maybe eligible for a waiver, but they're not doing the necessary steps to get onto the program or make themselves available. Is that, am I capturing what you're saying?
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, yes. Out of the 23,000 people that we help, that is the question. Yeah, what that aren't able to be on that because of some difficulties in the mental health issues.
Sure.
And if you could introduce yourself, and just briefly before that, I think it's safe to say that the mental health issue will certainly be something that's talked about. There's lots of groups focusing on it, legislation that will be coming forward, so we'll certainly be a lot of time to talk about this very challenge. But to what extent you have some brief comments, we'd love to hear that. If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Burdick with the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration at DHS. And to your question, Representative McDonald, you mentioned that sometimes folks with mental health issues will present at primary care physicians and other service systems. We do have a benefit under medical assistance that allows for some consultation with those providers to provide some more comprehensive consultation to them so that they can better address mental health issues and refer people on to appropriate services. I can't speak necessarily to the waiver aspect. That's another element of our department. But in addition, our mobile crisis teams are able to assist people in the community when they are experiencing a mental health crisis. And that has been a very effective service that we've been expanding over these years. And we'd be happy to follow up with you just more about the mental health service system in Minnesota if you'd like. Thank you.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Koppel. I'm looking at the elderly waiver, and I'm looking back, and let's say it was Bill, Marcus was the son, but let's say they're just in the senior age, and it's Bill and Marcus are husband and husband. And so does the elderly waiver, if you varied that scenario for a married couple, that would be Bill and Marcus in this instance, how would that, what elements of that would still be in play?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative, so you're asking the eligibility criteria around some of this if you have a married couple seeking the same outcome, to stay in their home even though they have numerous conditions and challenges, what would be available to them?
Yeah, for instance, I mean...
Representative Schoen.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, and Mr. Koppel. So Bill and Marcus have been married for 40 years. or, well, maybe 2 years in Minnesota now. But they have, one of them is kind of a primary caregiver, and is there elderly waiver segments of this that would be available to them?
If you could introduce yourself for the record and then answer Representative Schoen's question.
Madam Chair, Mark Schultz with the Aging and Adult Services Division, and we monitor the program for elderly waiver. The eligibility criteria is very unique, but it's individual-based, but it would take into account certain, the financial eligibility does take into account community living spouses for that program. So if the spouse was working or both of them are living together or the partners are living together, it would take that into account for that financial eligibility, which then would be applied to the benefits, the level of benefits. If that individual who is needing the care and meets the other service criteria eligibility, needing the nursing facility level of care, would desire that.
Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. My question relates to MA under 65 again. One of the things I picked up, Commissioner Koppel, is that there's no asset test. So just this scenario, individual has $1 million in an IRA, he just draws out enough to still be eligible for MA, so you don't take that asset into consideration?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I think someone is going to come down and help me.
You could introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, Kim Carlin from Healthcare Eligibility and Access at DHS. Your question is there an asset test or how?
Yeah.
Representative Grunhagen.
I could repeat myself. I do it quite a bit anyway. But, yeah, let's just say if there's no asset yet, I'm an individual and I've got $1 million in an IRA, and I only draw out enough income in a year, and I'm still eligible for MA. Do you count that $1 million in an IRA, since it's an asset, in terms of the eligibility for MA?
Madam Chair, Representative, for certain people under MA, there is no asset test. For other people, there is an asset test. For people whose eligibility is based on their age, over age 65, they're blind or disabled, there is an asset test. If you have assets in liquid assets in an account, that would count towards the asset limit.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, just clarification. I'm talking about somebody under 65.
Madam Chair, Representative, again, it depends on their basis of eligibility. So if you have an adult under age 65 with no dependents, the person does not receive Medicare, they can be eligible under the adults without children basis. There's no asset test. If a person is under 64 or under 65 and they want waiver services or they receive Medicare benefits or they're an SSI recipient, there is an asset test.
So Representative Grunhagen. Oh,
thank you, Madam Chair. So basically, if I understand you correctly, under 65 in terms of eligibility for MA, if they're drawing out, they get $1 million in an IRA, they can be eligible for MA in the state of Minnesota.
If their basis is adult without children, yes.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Just another follow-up. And this is based off memory. My understanding is that for the expansion of medical assistance, and maybe it's all medical assistance, again, I'm talking people under 65, okay? If I remember correctly, there's not only no asset test, there's also no residency test. And I believe that's a federal requirement. Is that correct?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, there is a state residency test for medical assistance.
Representative Grunhagen.
Even on the expansion?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I want to follow up actually on Glenn's question earlier about Mary and her two children. When later on maybe somebody moves into the home and actually has additional income for that family, there wasn't really I didn't hear a trigger point with whether they're married, engaged, or just living together, helping out the family income. I see that in my district, that I actually have people working for me, that I see that, and I quietly wonder what is the trigger point that will actually kick an employee or kick a resident, whoever it is, to say, gee, I see they make good money with me, but they're just under, and I know there's another person who's moved in. And so is there ever a trigger point, an annual residency test or something that kind of states that is anybody living in the residence? The marriage thing is another issue, but I'm wondering about that component about household income. That's, and it's real. I just want to have that answered for me, please.
Mr. Koppel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I didn't catch your...
Baker.
Baker, thank you. I'm going to ask, do we have an answer up there? Okay. Just a minute, please.
You're a familiar face, but if you could just introduce yourself for the record, that'd be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Larry Hosh. I'm with the Department of Human Services. I'm Representative Baker for the scenario with Mary for MFIP. Every year there's a recertification process that needs to occur. At that time, the applicant has to share information about income, family composition, and household composition. Oftentimes, household composition can be the hardest thing to verify. But when we go about counting income for that case, it's primarily the caregiver, the parent caregiver, and the people associated with that child, so the parent. If there's a shared household type of situation and the person in the shared household does not have a relation to the child, that income is not counted. But if I do want to also follow up to the previous question about if there's two people living in a household, do we count the income? If the second person is not the parent, we don't count the income. But if it is the parent, we do count as a two-parent household, and then there's different eligibility standards on that.
Okay, and I think we have one final, scratch that. First, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. On just that last point, I think it's also important to note that we hold parents accountable for the children that they have helped bring into the world and are responsible for. And we haven't talked about child care support, and I know there's very active programs to make sure that the non-present parent is contributing, as the court has determined that they should, and that is taken into account, because it's really the two parents of that child who share the responsibility for meeting the needs of that child, and we just haven't brought that up yet, so I thought it was important to get that there, because every county has a very active program that's responsible for following up on that. The other thing is that, you did a great job, Jim, and Assistant Commissioner Koppel, on the income limits on some of the other programs. You didn't on the elderly and disabled, and I think it's just really important for us to highlight that while we made eligibility for medical assistance much more generous under state policy with Minnesota Care and other changes, and under the Affordable Care Act, left behind were the elderly and the disabled, who are still left at the basic poverty level, which for one person, in one of your examples there, it's $932 a month, which is not very much. It won't get you an apartment, I know, in the Twin Cities and pay your utility bill and a phone bill. And if you earn $1 over that, because you got a little bit more in Social Security or a little more out of something, then you have to spend down to 75% of poverty, which is just over $700. So we have a situation in which we have elderly people and people with disabilities who are not able to work because of their health considerations, but we really impoverish them to a level that we don't any of these other populations. And on a bipartisan basis, there's been efforts in recent years to try and address that, because it's very, very difficult for some of these people. They're just at a point with their frail health that employment is not an option. And yet they just haven't gotten the same attention, because the focus has been, right or wrong, to try and focus attention on one group, but this is a group we still need to pay some attention to.
And I think we have one final question, and we'll be wrapping up. Representative Backer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards with Representative Baker's example, who is the person that goes out and does that verification each year? I'm assuming it's someone from the county?
Mr. Koppel.
And Madam Chair, Representative, yes, unless someone tells me that I'm wrong.
No. Just a minute, please. The question was, who goes out to verify eligibility? Is it a county worker?
Mr. Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Larry Hosh with DHS. Nobody goes out to the house. What happens is the recertification process has to occur. The application is filled out under penalty of perjury and fraud. They have to sign to and attest to the accuracy of the information. There's some verifications that are required to prove assets and income and, you know, pay stubs and those type of things. Also, paternity sometimes has to be established, but it's not like a county worker's knocking on the door of somebody's house and entering into their home. Recertification can be done in a number of ways. In-person interview, it can be done by internet telepresence, it can be done at a place that's mutually agreed upon by the applicant and the county, so it varies.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you very much, Mr. Koppel, for your presentation. I, being new to the department, very impressive. And I do think, I echo what Representative McDonald said, I think the stories help just with all these complicated programs understand how it kind of hits the ground and affects people personally. So thank you for that and to the people in the department who prepared it. And so just a reminder to those that it impacts, reminder that the Health and Human Services Finance Committee is meeting tomorrow at 12:45 is the start time, I believe. And then next week will be normal schedule and normal times for the respective separate committees. So thank you so much, Mr. Koppel. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.